only one here.
Bailey, while we're talking about this, is this...
I don't think that Tipp-Rac's going to add anything.
Different than what Tobias gave us, the 3039, has it changed since Tobias did the thing in caucus?
Okay.
About six or seven other things, so I'm bailing out now.
House Transportation will come to order.
Do you want me to do that again?
I think we're all a little relieved yesterday's over, so a little more lighthearted than we've been. And with that, welcome everybody, and I'm going to go ahead. I'm not going to work either of these bills today. I'm going to wait till we have full committee, but we're going to go ahead and take the opportunity to hear them. And I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 124. Senate Bill 124A. Patrick.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senate Bill 124A increases the penalty for operating a motorcycle without a motorcycle endorsement from a Class B traffic violation, which is punishable by a maximum fine of $360, to a Class A traffic violation, which is punishable by a maximum fine of $720. It authorizes the court to suspend or dismiss the fine if the operator completes the necessary training course and obtains a motorcycle endorsement within 120 days of sentencing.
Thank you, Patrick. Steve Garrels. Hopefully I've got that right.
Close enough.
Welcome.
Thank you. Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Steve Garrets. I'm the director of the Team Oregon Motorcycle Safety Program. Here to testify on Senate Bill 124A. You have before you my written testimony, and I'll review that with you. The background on this is unlicensed and unendorsed motorcycle riders continue to represent a significant number of motorcycle fatalities in Oregon. Our preliminary statistics from 2008 indicate that 17% of the riders killed in motorcycle crashes in Oregon were not properly licensed. We believe the current penalty for riding a motorcycle without an endorsement is not sufficient to encourage riders to become properly licensed. Other efforts to encourage proper licensing, for example, instance letters sent directly to unendorsed riders by the Governor's Advisory Committee on Motorcycle Safety in 2007 have met with very little success. Team Oregon currently offers two motorcycle training courses that are approved by the Department of Transportation for license testing waivers. We've got the BRT, Basic Rider Training, a 15-hour program. It's required for any rider under the age of 21. Riders over 21 are welcome to participate as well. Successful completion of the BRT waives both the skills test and the written test at Motor Vehicles Division. The Intermediate Rider Training, the IRT, is an 8-hour course that waives the successful completion, waives the skills test. The cost of these courses range from $125 for the IRT to a maximum of $179 for the BRT, and that includes the use of a motorcycle and a helmet if they don't have one of their own. We believe that the fine for riding without a proper endorsement should be severe enough to encourage riders to become properly trained and licensed. In 2008, 8,207 Oregon riders successfully completed the Team Oregon courses that provide license waivers, and that represents over half of the 14,268 motorcycle endorsements issued. We strongly believe that the training provided by Team Oregon has had a significant effect on lowering the number of motorcycle crashes and fatalities, and I direct you to this figure. In 2007, the most recent year that national statistics are available, the national rate of motorcycle fatalities was 7.23 per 10,000 registrations. Oregon's rate is 3.89, roughly half of that per 10,000 registrations. Our preliminary statistics for 2008 also indicate that the number of motorcycle fatalities in Oregon dropped by nearly 10% from 2007. In summary, Team Oregon strongly believes that training and proper licensing can have a significant effect in lowering the number of motorcycle crashes and fatalities. We believe that increasing the penalty for riding without a motorcycle endorsement can be effective in encouraging riders to become properly licensed and trained. We support Senate Bill 124 and ask that the committee also support this bill.
Thank you. Any questions? Seeing none. Thank you for
Thank
your
you
testimony.
Very much.
Jim Stewart.
Thank you.
welcome to go ahead.
Good afternoon, Madam Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Jim Stewart. I serve as the chairman of the Governor's Advisory Committee for Motorcycle Safety. It is our committee that is sponsoring this particular bill, Senate Bill 124A. We know that across the nation that motorcycle crashes involving injuries and fatalities are rising. Oregon, even though with a good record that Steve pointed out, certainly is not an exception. Over the years, our rates have increased, just not as dramatically. However, one thing that has held steady and shown moderate increases is the amount of unlicensed riders that we have. And I'm going to use the term unlicensed and unendorsed riders synonymous. The Governor's Advisory Committee on Motorcycle Safety believes that unlicensed and untested motorcyclists should incur a severe penalty for endangering not only themselves but others. Motorcyclists riding without an endorsement has been overrepresented in Oregon's motorcycle fatal injury crashes for quite some time. In fact, if we go back nearly 30 years, back to 1981, the Oregon Traffic Safety Commission found that nearly 27% of motorcycle operators had no motorcycle endorsement. That's approximately 45 times the amount you would find in an automobile population, automobile driver. Today, there were 46 motorcycle fatalities in 2008, and of the 272 motorcyclists who've died in the last 5 years, since 2003, 26% were unlicensed, did not have an endorsement, 1 out of 4. Now, we feel this is a very, very important item here, that receiving an endorsement implies that there is some training and proficiency attained somewhere in this process. And believe me, proficiency matters. If we look at just Oregon, 60% of the fatalities were single vehicle accidents. These are motorcyclists killing themselves. And in 77% of those cases, it was the motorcyclist at fault. This is an analysis of the fatality. Now, we're not even talking about other crashes. We're just talking about fatalities. An endorsement validates a minimum of proficiency. Now, training, Mr. Garrett just related to, is a separate but not an unrelated issue. In fact, we've incorporated training into this bill as we go on a little bit further. Let's look at some other data. Remember, we were talking nearly 30 years ago, we had a 27% non-licensed public. In 2005, only 8 of the 320 people who were cited for not having an endorsement went ahead and successfully completed their legal requirement. It got worse in 2006. It was only 4 people out of 327 who were convicted and then went ahead and followed up. Now, this is when those alarming statistics really reached a pinnacle with our committee. We started action at that time to compose this bill. The next year wasn't much better, 39 out of 248. That means in those 3 years, it was less than 6% of people who were convicted of driving unlicensed went ahead and obtained an endorsement. So here's what we did at first to confront these shocking statistics. Working with Department of Motor Vehicles, we sent a personal letter, not dear occupant, but directed right to the owner of 12,000 motorcycles in this state who did not show an endorsement. With this letter, we said, you are breaking the law. Here is the fine you are subject to, which, it being a Class B violation, was a maximum of $360 fine. here is what you can do to remedy this situation. We set up special classes. You could make appointments with your local DMV. We gave several alternatives. Throughout the entire year, we had an entire response of 600 people. Now, 600 out of 12,000, 5%. You notice that's not much different than what we were seeing earlier. Okay, next step. Through 2008, our committee held 5 different public forums on motorcycle safety-related issues around the state. 2 in Portland, 1 in Medford, 1 in Bend, 1 in Eugene. The majority of the people who gave public testimony to those hearings indicated very strong support for increasing the penalty. We need to send a very clear message to the riding community about the importance of both testing and training for all motorcyclists. Now, on the written form that you have, it shows a little flowchart, or a little spreadsheet, pardon me, of our price differential. The basic rider training course that Team Oregon offers costs $179. The motorcycle endorsement through DMV is $77, totaling $256. The current maximum fine is $360. That is only a difference of $104. Is this worth the risk? It seems to be to many with the aforementioned results, to Oregon in general and to motorcycles in particular. We are not going anywhere with getting the unlicensed persons registered. Now, Senate Bill 124 was amended to include the following provision for a motorcyclist to have their fine waived if they complete and successfully pass a motorcycle training course through Team Oregon and then acquire their motorcycle endorsement. This committee envisions this as a positive step toward the goal of getting all motorcyclists properly endorsed. So, in conclusion, we have too many motorcyclists in Oregon riding without endorsement. We're looking for Senate Bill 124A to increase the penalty. Other options have, between the small difference in the cost and the penalty obtained, has not seemed to have had any effect. And these individuals are contributing to Oregon's increase in motorcycle injuries and fatalities. The Governor's Advisory Committee on Motorcycle Safety supports this bill and asks this committee to support it as well. Open for questions, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Representative Bailey.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Yes, sir.
I appreciate the testimony, Mr. Stewart, and I'll save the committee the long story, but I want to compliment Team Oregon on their program. I've taken their program and used it to receive my endorsement, and even after having received the endorsement, I'll save the committee the sight of showing you the very large scar on my knee from a single vehicle motorcycle accident that landed me in the hospital and unable to walk for a month. So I guess my question is, while I understand the intent here, does an increase in the size of the fine from 360 to 720 get the job done? I'm a big fan of using price to induce behavior, but if the threat of maiming and dismemberment and death doesn't induce people to seek an endorsement and proper training for a motorcycle, does an extra $360 do the trick? And have we looked at other methods of doing this, such as perhaps ways to prevent registration of motorcycles or tying registration more closely with endorsements or other methods? Why was this chosen as the most effective way to increase training amongst motorcyclists?
Representative Bailey, I understand your position that even with training you were not immune to an accident. We certainly recognize this as motorcyclists. However, everything that we have seen is that between 18 and 40% of our fatalities are coming from the unlicensed rider. So our feeling was any training, any, whether it be just passing a test at the minimal level in a parking lot, or, which is what one way of getting your endorsement now, or taking formal training through Team Oregon, is going to be better for that rider. It doesn't make them full safe. These are only beginning steps. Now, we felt with the minimal difference in price of only that $100, we felt that was too small of an incentive factor. We felt if that was increased, it wouldn't have an effect. In fact, just 2 weeks ago at our committee meeting, we heard from an assistant director of Team Oregon as well as one of their long-term instructors stories of they had people show up for their intermediate level classes who have had between 10 and 15 years of riding, had never been endorsed. And their statement was, I guess I better take this course to get my endorsement, rather than saying, I guess I better take this Team Oregon course to make me a better, more proficient, hence more safe rider. So whether the word was out about the status of this bill, or they thought, you know, it's just not worth risking the money any longer. I'm not sure what their motive was. But this bill is getting noticed, let's say, amongst the motorcycling community.
Brief follow-up.
Yes, sir.
Just as a clarification, I'm not questioning the efficacy of the training. The story was merely to illustrate my understanding of the issues. I guess as a final comment, I think the bill is fine. I just will be interested to see if it is able to achieve the intended effect.
Thank you. Any other questions? Seeing none, thank you for coming.
Thank you, Mrs. Chairman.
Wayne Schumacher. Welcome.
Chair Beyer, members of the committee, my name is Wayne Schumacher, and I appear before you today as representing Bike Pack of Oregon. Bike Pack of Oregon is in support of Senate Bill 124 with some concerns, and I'd like to bring those to your attention today if I could. If you look at here in Gross Bill 124, first page, line 25, it's talking about the ability to suspend the fine if they go through a Team Oregon course or a state-sponsored course within 120 days of sentencing. We have a real concern about the word may. We think it should be shall, because our concern is the extreme inconsistency between jurisdictions that will happen. So you may have some particular judge that says, you know, they're not going to pay attention to it, some that will. We're concerned that everybody gets treated equally. And we think that the carrot-stick concept, which is what this would be the carrot part of this, is a very positive step as far as improving the bill language. We don't like to see carrots sticks without carrots in it, and so we think that's been an improvement. In fact, we did ask for this amendment over in the Senate, and unfortunately the language didn't come out quite the way we had hoped. Speaking to that same issue, and you will be seeing Senate Bill 546, which was introduced by Senator Vicky Walker. It was a mandatory training bill that basically says if you're going to get your endorsement that you have to go through a state-sponsored course. You'll be seeing that in your committee because it has passed over in the House the Transportation Committee, and I believe is voted on either today or will be tomorrow. We expect that to pass. In that bill, Senator Walker took out language that was much more extensive with regards to the procedure of getting that fine waive if you're taking a course. I would like to work with staff, as I'd mentioned to the chair, of getting that language amended into this bill, which would pretty much define how it would take place, and everybody would get the same kind of treatment. So we would like to see that for an improvement in the bill. Other than that, we'd be in support of the language. So I'd be glad to answer any questions you might have.
Any questions? Representative Edwards.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I have to ask the question, why did the Senate not approve or otherwise include the proposed amendments?
It kind of happened after the fact. We weren't sure that Senator Walker was moving forward with 546, and by the time we found that, we noticed that in her language she had some fairly extensive, and she'd worked very hard with legislative counsel. And so the bills were kind of coming in at different times, so they didn't quite get together, and the committee had actually passed 124 before I actually even saw the final language that Senator Walker had. When I met with Senator Walker, she agreed very much that she'd like to see the language incorporated into 124, and therefore she would take it out of her bill 546. So that was kind of what happened.
Yes, follow-up.
Follow-up, thank you. And so the sponsor of 124 is amenable to incorporating the language that Senator Walker developed?
Yes, sir. Yes.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. And with that, I don't see any other questions, and I assume that, you know, both of these bills, should the other one pass, will be in my committee, and we can coordinate what to do with them.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you. All right. That's all I have signed up on that bill. And I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 124A and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 127. Is that A, too? Nope.
It's B.
B, engrossed, 127.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. Senate Bill 127B clarifies responsibilities for individuals to show proof of compliance with financial responsibility requirements after their vehicle is involved in an uninsured motor vehicle collision. The measure clarifies the offense of failure to make future responsibility filings after an accident. It requires filings to be made within 30 days and adds risk retention group to allowed insurers filing certificate of insurance. The measure also eliminates required statements for vehicles not operated on public highways to obtain exemption from financial responsibility requirements.
Thank you, Patrick. And I have Lana Culley.
Chair Byer, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Lana Culley, and I am the DMV Program Services Manager. Senate Bill 127, the B engrossed, removes provisions of law that are obsolete and impractical for us to administer. It also clarifies provisions that cause confusion for both DMV, the public, law enforcement, and the insurance industry. We believe that clarifying the laws and eliminating the obsolete language will make the financial responsibility statutes easier to understand. And what I'd like to do is kind of quickly go through the sections of the bill. Section 1, it allows a person currently to send a statement to DMV telling us that their vehicle is not being continuously operated on the highways. However, if the vehicle's not being operated on the highways, it's not subject to insurance requirements. So there's really no purpose in that statement. And we have found that people have tried to use that as a loophole. They want to go ahead and register the vehicle, but they want to give us a statement saying it's not being operated continuously right now. And so we're like, well, why do you want to register it then? But they believe that they should be able to submit this statement and go ahead and register saying that they, well, they're really not driving it, but they want to keep the registration current. So this will clarify that the vehicle is not subject to insurance if it's not being operated on the highways. It is if it is being operated on the highways. So we just want to take that provision of the statement out of there. Section 2 requires us to notify the county DA of our belief that a person residing in their county is driving uninsured or has provided false insurance information. That kind of information has never been provided to the DAs, and we do not believe that they have any interest in receiving that information, and they've never requested that information from us. So we wanted to just remove that. Section 3 and 4, both of those sections are amending to add a time frame for insurance companies to respond to us. It requires them to respond to us, but there's no time frame for them to do that. So it could be that, like, we ask for verification of insurance on an accident report, and we may not get that response from the insurance company till months down the road. And then when we do get it, we have to take action to suspend that person, but it may be months down the road. So we're just putting a time frame in there for them to respond to us. Section 5 is to clean up some language. There were some changes in the 2003 session for reporting an accident, when you have to report an accident. But this section of the statute was not amended to match those requirements. So currently it requires somebody to submit proof of insurance to us, even though they didn't have to report the accident. And we don't believe that was the intent when those changes were made to the accident reporting requirements. So this removes that provision, and you only have to provide proof of insurance to us if we know that you were uninsured at the time of the accident, which follows the rest of the financial responsibility statutes. Section 6, this is just to make clear what satisfies the requirement for filing the SR-22, which is your proof of insurance. It also removes language that allows a person to request their SR-22 certificate that they submitted to us as proof back from us if they provide other adequate proof. We've never had anybody ask for that back, and we don't know what that adequate proof would be other than the SR-22 certificate, so it just didn't make sense. Section 7, this is to clarify that an SR-22 filing is required. The SR-22 filing that's required for a hardship permit, this is to clarify that it expires, the need for that, at the time the hardship permit expires. There's some confusion out there that customers have to have that SR-22 for 3 years with their hardship permit, and they don't. It's only required during the time of the hardship permit. Now, they may be required to file an SR-22 for other reasons for those 3 years, but if it's related to the hardship permit, it's only required as long as the hardship permit is valid. Section 8 is to align Oregon law with some new proposed national standards for the date on the SR-22 certificate. Section 9 is to remove some old language that's not used anymore, and it also clarifies the insurers that we can accept SR-22 certificates from. Section 10 is to remove a reference related to bond and deposit options for insurance. Those options for bonds or deposits were removed in 2003, and this, for some reason, got missed. And then Section 11 is just repealing one of the statutes that's in Section 1 that's being removed, and then the two other statutes that are related to the bond and deposits, again, that got missed. So with that, I ask for your support, and I will answer any questions that you might have.
Thank you, Representative Berger.
This is a little complicated bill, unless you're pretty familiar with DMV laws, and frankly, I'm not. So are there policy changes in this bill? Are there specific areas of this bill where a policy is substantially changed by this language, or is it primarily intended as a bill to clean up inconsistencies and clarify where it wasn't clear statutory provisions?
Chair Beyer, Representative Berger, there was a policy in it before it got amended on the Senate side. At this point, it's just clarifying.
I want to know about what I'm reading right here. So essentially, there's no policy changes in this bill.
Correct.
It's just a clarifying.
Removing old language that's not used, clarifying, making sure there's no loopholes for people to use.
Okay. Yes. No policy changes.
Correct.
Thank you.
Any other questions? I don't see any other questions, so thank you.
Thanks.
And that's all I have signed up, and I don't really see too many other people here that are jumping up to testify, so I'm going to go ahead and close the public hearing on Senate Bill 127B, and thank the committee for all their hard work in the last week or so trying to clear out house bills, and I'm going to we are not meeting Friday,
So you'll have maybe an early afternoon, maybe. And enjoy the weekend. And thank you again. And we are adjourned.
Wow.